So, welcome to the I Am Jen Wilson, the Healing Rebel podcast. I am Jen Wilson, and with me today, I have Megan McLean, who I only have just met recently through social media. I was on her membership recently doing a wee talk to her members about gut health. So, thank you very much for having me on. And when we were chatting before we did that, I was like, oh, can you come on my podcast and share some of your story? So I'm excited to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me today. So why don't you do a wee intro to yourself, who you are, what you do, and why you do it?
Okay, guys. I'm Megan Stewart. I'm known as Megan McLean Fitness, though. I've kept that because it's an ode to my dad. I've been a personal trainer for the last 4 years. I started that because I've always had an overwhelming need to help people, I would say. I've always worked in care beforehand. And I think that sort of thing, when you feel like that, sometimes comes from your childhood and kind of your past and stuff like that. So I think to tell my story, I'll start there. Might be a long-winded story, but I'll start there.
Go for it.
So my mum has always been an alcoholic as long as I can remember. My dad used to tell me stories of how he would find her down the pub when she was pregnant with me as well. So that didn't even stop her then. My mum and dad got divorced when I was very small, when I was about 3 or 4. My mum met a man, an Irishman, who was very violent towards her. So he had like the tattoos or like the red hand of Ulster and things like that. So he was like her kind of partner for a number of years when I was younger. So the first kind of memories I have of that. I know this goes way back to the reasons why I became a coach. That's why I've started talking about this. We stayed in a number of different places. So we stayed, the first place that I can remember was Barassi. That was the first place out of 6 or 7 places I think we stayed. So I went to 6 different primary schools. So in Barassi, that's when I was quite young. An overall memory that I have of during that time was my mum tried to kill herself in front of me and my sister. So we used to live in high-rise flats in Barassi, and she would, I remember her trying to run kind of out the window and her jumping out and him grabbing onto her and pulling her back and her kind of sobbing on the floor saying that she wanted to die and things like that. So that was my most vivid memory of being kind of at the beginning of living with that man. After that, we moved to Pollock. So we stayed in a couple of different places in Glasgow. So we were in Pollock and then we moved to Barrhead. My mum was still what you would call a mum at that point, I would say. Although there was a lot of violence towards her from him. She would still give you like your pocket money to go to the van and stuff like that. She would still cook you meals and stuff. So she was still trying her best to be a mum as what she could at that point. Although the violence towards her was bad. She when we moved from there to Newcastle, that's probably when it took a turn and it kind of got at its worst. He would like break her jaw, break her arms, like things like that. The violence was quite bad by that point. And I always very much remember that she fought back quite badly. Like she had, she wasn't, she was quite aggressive back. So it was a very back and forward thing between them. So she would, as far as I can remember, she, I think she maybe stabbed him a couple of times as well. Like there was a lot of violence there between the both of them. Again, something that stands out for me at that point was think one of the nights I could hear her scream, but it was different. It was a different sort of shouting, things like that. So I think I was maybe about 7 at this point, I'm not sure. And then I had kind of opened the door and he was like trying to rape her basically. But I kind of shouted at him, stop doing that to my mum. And I grabbed her cat. I grabbed her cat and I threw it on his back. So obviously he wasn't very happy about that. And he chased me from the room. But for some reason, I don't really understand why he was never violent towards me or my sister. So it was always just me and my sister that had stayed, but my mum and my brother had moved to stay with his father when he was quite young, when I was quite young, so it was just me and her. My sister had moved to Newcastle with us at this point. She was pregnant at the time, and she had always been like my mum as such, if you know, because she was always there for me. So at this point, you know, the violence was very, very bad between them. She was in hospital a number of times, and I think that was kind of the, what's he saying? You say it, the straw that broke the camel's back. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
After this, we moved to Dumfries, and that's where when she had left him. But that was after a number of years. I think by this point, I was maybe, I'm not sure, 8 or 9. So this has been going on since I was about, I'm not sure, 3 or 4. So it was for a number of years, but at this point, my sister had decided that she wasn't going to come with us. She was going to move back to Glasgow and have her baby. So it was just me and my mum that was left. So this is where, like, my mum's neglect as such took, although there was now no longer violence, her neglect took a kind of new level,
Yeah.
because her drinking got a lot worse. So we moved to Dumfries and we went into Women's Aid. So in Women's Aid, we eventually got a house, and we were placed there. So by this point, I had been, this is now my fifth primary school by this point. So by this point, I had kind of given up on making friends at this point. I've got a memory of just feeling very, very alone. I never knew that a child could be depressed, but clearly they can. So by this point, I just remember like walking around school by myself, not having any friends. So remember by this point as well, my learning at school was not great. I was in all the foundation classes because I never got a chance to learn because I was always moving on. I was never sitting at home. No, yeah, you were never sitting at home with your mum doing your homework. Like sometimes I'll hear my clients talk about the things that they do with their children, like they take them to different clubs, they sit and they do their homework with them. You know, there's never anything like that for me. Sorry, it's quite hard to talk about.
I'm amazed that you've made it this far. Like this part of your journey so far is incredible. Your survival instincts have been amazing.
So anyway, I think the point at this point, because I was alone with my mum and my sister wasn't there, I would usually go around to, you know, when a phone box was a thing, I would go around and I'd try and phone my sister, and sometimes she would answer and sometimes she wouldn't. And then when she wouldn't answer, like I would be very upset because I just felt very alone at this point. I had tried to run out in front of traffic as well to take my own life because I just couldn't deal with it anymore. My mum, I would come home from school and she wouldn't be there. I would have to sit for hours outside the house, like till it was dark, because she would be at the pub. And this was regularly, this was most days. I was so hungry all the time, all the time. I would steal food from school. It was just, it wasn't great. None of the teachers, I'm not sure, I don't think that any of them really noticed the such, or if they did, nothing was ever said about it at this point. She would bring me.
What sort of era was this? Was this like 90s, 2000s?
Oof. Well, I left my mum's care when I was 10, so I was about maybe 9 at this point. I think I stayed there for about a year. And I'm 36 now, so yeah, so it would have been about the 90s. Yeah, round about then. So it's like she would bring men home and I could hear them like having sex and things like that. And it's just wasn't a pleasant environment like for a child. So at this point, I think we had gone up to visit my sister in Glasgow at one point. My mum had gotten really, really drunk. And my sister had had enough because my mum had hit me and then she'd left to go to the pub and she'd phoned my dad. By this point, my dad had remarried and he had a wife called Anne. She's my stepmom. So she'd phoned and said to my dad, look, Megan wants to come and stay with you. She can't do this anymore. My dad had previously tried to get custody of me a few times, but because he was on his own, he wasn't successful. I
Which
used
is
to, I know.
cool.
I used to go and stay with him maybe once every 2 weeks for a weekend. And that was like heaven to me because I would go there and my dad would make me my dinner and I would sit and I would eat it. And he would stand over me and he'd be like, how are you taking hours to eat your dinner? He's like, okay, you couldn't understand. And like, I would just sit with it because I wasn't used to eating. That's why. So anyway, by this point, I would go and stay with him at the weekends and things, and he would bring me home and we would wait for hours for my mum to turn up, for him to leave me with her, and then she would turn up in a taxi and follow the taxi drunk and be shouting and swearing, and he was livid that he had to leave me with her, but he had no other choice. So he had to leave. So anyway, they were reported to social work, and by this point, my mum had left me in the house myself again at some point, going to the pub, and the social work came to the door. And they asked to come in, and I sat down and like, so where's your mum? And I was like, oh, she's just gone to the shop, she'll be here soon. All this, sat for a couple of hours, obviously she didn't appear. And then I was put into temporary care custody before I went to stay with my dad. So my mum didn't fight it, she allowed me to go and stay with my dad. A memory that I have that was like very vivid before I left was, my favourite meal was always was tuna on toast. That's what I would get. Tuna on toast and a cup of tea. And I remember her giving this to me in the last day before I left her. And just the feeling of, I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I felt like it was my birthday or something. Like I was looking at her and I was like, why are you feeding me? Kind of thing. Like that's a vivid memory for me before I left. So yeah, so I went to, over the years, I went and stayed with my dad. My dad was the best dad I could possibly have ever asked for, as was my stepmom, man. They turned my life around big time. That's what they did, sorry.
They were able to fill the gaps of love that and support that you weren't able to get before.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, I said I wasn't going to cry in this.
Can't help it because it's your life and it's your real life, it's your journey.
So yeah, so anyway, I started primary school there, and again, remembering the fact that I had been to six different primary schools, a vivid memory I have was, I don't know whether they still do this or not, but the teacher would go around the class and they would ask a certain child to stand up and tell your timetables. So she got to me, obviously.
That I could never do them.
Yeah, so well, anyway, she asked me to do my two times table, and I stood up and I was absolutely mortified because I couldn't do it. I didn't know it. And all the other children were looking at me and they're like, oh, I can't believe, like, you're so, oh, we thought you were smart and all this. And like, it was horrible. It was a horrible experience. And I went home and I sat with my dad and I went, right, I'm never letting that happen to me again. So I made him sit down with me. I learned all my times tables. I wanted to be the fastest in school, so he would stand with me at my back door and make me run up and down my garden, and he would time me and I'd go faster, and he would take me down the park and just try and build me up as a person, I suppose, you know. But anyway, yeah, he was, him and
Yeah,
Anne were great.
you could do.
Yeah.
He already knew how strong you were because he could see what you had survived up until him taking you under his wing and being able to be there full time. And he was able to nourish and nurture all those amazing skills that you already had to help you thrive.
Yeah, I always say, like, if I hadn't went to stay with my dad, like, I would have ended up pregnant at 15, or, you know, like, somewhere I didn't want to be. But because I had that opportunity to go and stay with him, I was able to turn it around. Although I gave him hell once I turned into a teenager, which I'm sure most people did. Yeah, so from there, like leading through my teenage years, like I suffered so badly with such low self-esteem. It was crippling. I hated myself. Like that comes through again, that comes through when you're a child, they say if you experience violence or fear, then that you build this low self-esteem, these gremlins, as they call them in your mind, that you don't think you're good enough, imposter syndrome, all that sort of thing. Like, and it really affected me during my teenage years, going into my 20s. From that, well, my first boyfriend kind of got me into cannabis, so I took a lot of drugs through my teenage years. I was just trying to black out how I felt about myself, about all that sort of thing. And then I got kind of, I would say, was I addicted? I would say I was addicted to cannabis for a number of years. In the beginning, I loved it. It was great. You know, it made me feel good. It made me forget about things. It made me laugh. But as the years started to progress, like, it started to take a darker turn towards my mental health. I had to smoke more of it to be get the same feeling. I had terrible anxiety and depression. I never took any medication for it because I watched my mum take Prozac for years, and I just didn't want to. I don't know, I suppose in my head I didn't want to turn out like her, you know. So from that, my mental health was just really, really bad, really bad. And I really wanted to get away from it at this point. Like, I was in a relationship for about 5 years with that other person. It was heavily involved in our relationship. But it got to the point where I just couldn't do it anymore, and I came away from him. And it was at this point when I met my husband, Mark. Mark is well, he was an athlete. He was in the Scotland karate squad. So he was into the gym, he was into healthy eating, all that sort of thing. My taste buds, or what you would say, like the way that I ate, was not developed in any sort of way. So when I met him, he introduced me to all sorts of different healthy foods, and things like that. Now, at this point, I was still coming back of in and out of smoking cannabis. I was trying to get away from it. At this point, I had stopped, and some, I don't know, I can't remember like where we got it, but we got some sort of weed cookies from somewhere. I don't know what it was. And then me being the big man said, oh, I'll eat half of one of those. And Mark was like, I don't think you should, because you've came away from that for such a long time. And I was like, no, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. Wasn't fine. The only thing that I can I don't know if it was, but the only thing that I can think to describe it as is a psychosis, because I didn't know who I was, I didn't know who he was. The anxiety that came from that and the months leading that nearly ruined my life. It was awful. It was so bad. Me and Mark nearly split over it, up over it a number of times. I almost moved out because I think I associated him with the anxiety, because he was there at that point. And any time I saw him, I would just burst out in tears, and I'd be so anxious, and it was horrible. It was one of the worst mental health periods of my time I've ever had. I just remember being in the shower one day, and I was like, if I feel like this for the rest of my life, I just don't want to be here. Can't deal with us. And that was a kind of turning point for me. I was like, I can't do that anymore to myself. Like, it needs to stop.
I think there's a difference between eating cannabis and smoking cannabis, like how it responds in metabolism in your body. Because I've heard people talk about that before, like people that are big stoners and they smoke all the time, and they're like, oh, if I eat it, I just get super paranoid. And they, like the person I was listening to, was talking about a friend of theirs who'd eaten it and then had a psychotic break. And he's like, it can happen with edibles, and it's a really strong, powerful plant which can be used in the right situation, right circumstances. It can be a very healing medicinal plant, but when abused, like anything, when overdone, abused, used as your crutch, it becomes problematic.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So, funnily enough, that is what caused my anxiety. And then to get me out of my anxiety, this was after taking propranolol, diazepam, all sorts of things from the doctor. It just didn't work for me. I ended up taking CBD oil. So I thank that for saving my life, because see, when I started taking that, like that, my anxiety started to disappear. And it's weird though that that I took, like, to know that that was the kind of thing that kind of helped me in the end. So from this, after that, I did a number of different courses to try and help with the way that I felt about myself. One of the courses I did was with a psychologist called Dr. D. Martini. I don't know if you've ever heard of him at all. He's quite well known in that field. So he did a number of workshops. This comes to where my overall story comes to. So he did a workshop about how to heal yourself and things like that. Now, he told a story about a woman that he did a workshop with who had been gang raped. So he did a workshop with her because he was trying to help her heal from that. Now, obviously, that is one of the most horrific things that can ever happen to a woman, and something that you might never get over. So he worked with this lady and he helped her to try and forgive the people that had done this to her. Now, she wasn't forgiving those people for them. She was forgiving them so that she could gain some sort of semblance of her life to move on and actually have a life after that happening. Now, after I heard this, I was quite shocked because I thought, how can anyone forgive anyone for that? And when I heard that story, I really took away from it that if that woman can find it within herself to forgive for that, then I can forgive my mum. Mm-hmm. So I went down to see her and I sat down with her. At this point, she was still drinking, and I just looked at her and I just thought, you know, you're just a poor wee soul. She was sitting there crying. My mum herself had been abused when she was younger. She'd been battered her whole adult life by men. Now, there was choices that she made throughout that. I acknowledge that. But at the same time, you know, I sat and I looked at her and I thought, you know what? For me to move on as a person and to gain happiness within myself, to let go of my bitterness, to try and heal myself, I need to forgive you for everything that's happened. And that's what I did. Yeah. I forgave her. And from that day, I have never harboured a bit of anger or bitterness towards her. And it's been a weight lifted off my shoulders. And that leads on to why I became a coach. seems like a bit of a long story. But
it's a really important story, like super important, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I became a coach because I've always wanted to help people. And when Mark introduced me to the gym, healthier eating, that was a way for me as well to pour what I have into making myself a better person, feeling better about myself health-wise, mental health-wise. So I thought, why not combine the two things? Helping people, the thing that I'm passionate about, and becoming a coach it's definitely been the making of me as a person. I get so much joy out of seeing women becoming more confident, letting go of their own anxieties, seeing their health flourish. It's something that gives me a great deal of joy. So my overall message that was to come out of what you said was, forgiveness doesn't always have to be about the other person. You can forgive someone so that you yourself can heal and move on and let go of that hate and anger and bitterness and, you know, just live your life.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah.
It's quite incredible. And I think part of forgiveness is about acceptance as well. Yeah. Like, this is something that I learned in therapy myself, that we have expectations of other people. So you expect a mother to be a mother and look after and nurture and nourish and bring up their child. And if they don't meet those expectations, you can get angry about that.
Yeah.
But that's, and obviously your situation is very, very extreme. And this is just one example. It could, like for me, my anger often lies with people in the NHS because I feel like they should be doing more to help me and learn more about my condition and,
mm-hmm.
like, look at the bigger picture rather than just, well, here's a medication, that's it, right, get out of the office kind of thing. And I'm like, why are these people not? And that was one of the things, like, that my therapist was like, you have to let go of your expectations of what you think they should do. If just because that's what you would do, that's on you, that's not on them.
Yeah.
And getting into this place of acceptance and then forgiving yourself for holding on to angers and resentments.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yes, you're forgiving somebody else, but then can you forgive yourself also for holding them to a higher level than they're maybe capable of, because they've got a history and they've got a story and they've got...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all tied in. So it is. I quite often talk to my clients as well about things like that, about expectations and stuff, and how sometimes maybe their expectations of other people are too high and then they become disappointed as such. I think I've let that go with my mum now. My mum, she's stopped drinking now for the past 4 years. So like that, I thought that my mum would have been dead by now. I thought that she would never stop drinking, ever. But for the past 4 years, she's given up alcohol. She's like a completely different person. She has been diagnosed with early onset dementia. She's only 68. But I think that's been caused from her drinking throughout the years. She can't get about much. She's needing a hip replacement. So one of the times that she was drunk, she was locked in a house by another current partner who was abusing her, and she jumped out the window again. Another jump out the window, and she broke her hip, her collarbone, her arm, trying to escape. And she has been in pain for years. So she has. It's really quite bad. But when I go and see her now, like, she's just like a wee old woman, you know?
Yeah.
She's just a wee old woman that she can't remember anything. Like, sometimes my sister would say, my sister would come in, she'd rant at her, you don't understand what you've done, you don't know this. And I was like, Faye, what's the point? This woman doesn't remember anything that you're saying to her. One, because she was drunk, and two, she now has dementia. So,
there's
no point.
See, like, that anger and resentment is like you taking the rat poison and expecting the other person to die.
Yeah.
It's eating you up inside. So that being able to get into that space of forgiveness. So if somebody's listening to this and there's a situation or whatever that they need to forgive, what sort of process would you advise them to embark on? Like, do you have specific tools that you worked through, or...
So one of the things that that Dr. DeMartini had said to do in order for forgiveness, he said that in every situation in life, there's always someone in that situation that's trying to help you. You might not think that there is, but there always is. Now, the way that he put it, he used mine as an example for the situation for my mum jumping out the window trying to kill herself. He said, who in that moment was trying to help you? Who tried to help you in that moment? And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, well, it was the man. He was the one that grabbed your mum, brought him back in. He's like, so look at that in a way that although you had this, you hated him. Weirdly enough, I didn't hate him for some reason. In that moment, that man was trying to make sure that harm wasn't done to you because of what you would have seen with your mum. He's like, so try and take that as a semblance of forgiveness, even for him. So yeah. I thought that that was really quite powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It was. So yeah, I wouldn't have said there was a process. I would have said time. It takes time.
Yeah.
Because things can be quite raw at the time, but as the years pass, trying to understand maybe someone else's situation rather than just looking at your situation, maybe try and look at from an outside perspective of, right, what is that person's situation? What have they went through? What have they had to experience? I would say that.
Being able to kind of look in as an observer so that you're detaching yourself from your emotions.
Mm-hmm. Which is a very difficult thing to do. Most people don't do that because we react angrily. We react instantly without actually taking that time to stop and actually think about how we're feeling and why we're feeling that way rather than looking at it from an outside perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of compassion work comes in there.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think that's, as a coach, when I coach people, I tend to keep my clients for at least a year, 2 years, some three. I've got, and I think that's because I've got a very high level of empathy for their situation and things like that. And I think that's been built up just from my own experiences.
Yeah. And do you do any kind of journaling or... Have you done any like hypnosis or tapping or any
No, I've never done any of that. I have done journaling in the past, though. Yeah, I do find that very, very helpful. I do still, like everyone else, have that those demons that come up, the imposter syndrome, like, are you good enough? All that sort of thing. It's very difficult to come away from that. And I did recently go for an ADHD assessment, because I felt like something was just holding me back in life, and I just couldn't pinpoint what it was. But he basically said everything was down to childhood trauma. I don't 100% believe him, if I'm honest, because I do think that maybe my mum might have had ADHD, but I'm not sure. Of course, I'm not a psychiatrist, so.
Yeah, because I have heard like Gabor Maté talks about that. He says that ADHD, in his experience, is the root cause of it is the trauma. So if your mum experienced it and she had trauma from a young age as well, then that is a possibility of it being
Yeah.
one thing. But then if that doesn't, if you go, okay, well, I've dealt with my childhood trauma and I still feel this way, then maybe there's something else
Yeah.
that needs nourishment in your body to help you feel more calm or more focused, or looking at it as a, how do I take this and funnel it into a thing? Like some people with ADHD are like super successful and they're like, I block out everything else and I just put all that energy and attention into whatever it is that they want to be obsessed about. And
See, this is one of the reasons why I thought I might have been, because the gym, all that sort of thing, like, I am super, like, obsessed with it. So it is, but see, things that I'm not interested in, I'm not interested in at all. And there's loads and loads of different things in my personality and the way that I am that I put to him about, and every single thing that I said, he had an answer for, and he argued back that it could have been this, it could have been something else. And I just didn't feel like it was very helpful. He even offered me the ADHD medication, even though he didn't think I had it as well. He said, "Oh, what we'll do is we'll just bump your scores up. You can come back and get another test, and we could try you on the medication, and we could just see if it helps." And I said, "So you're going to give me ADHD medication, even though you're saying that you don't think I have it?"
yeah, that does not make like that. I shouldn't even be allowed.
No, I don't think it is allowed.
I'm like, no, that doesn't sound right.
No, that's what I thought. I was so annoyed because I was so convinced that I did. And I've got quite a few clients who have got ADHD, and every one of them have said to me, "You are 100%, you
Yeah.
definitely have." And then this man is sitting telling me that I don't, but he'll give me the medication for it. So, yeah.
That needs reported. Like, oh my God. 'Cause I mean, the medication that they give for ADHD is not harmless.
No.
You know what
Exactly.
I
We could just see how you get on. It could help. That was all right. So
mean?
anyway, maybe I'm undiagnosed. Who knows?
So what does a daily routine look like for you to help you stay? Are you still off cannabis?
Oh
Like, is
yes, I have not smoked cannabis for a long time. Like, yeah, years and years.
Yeah. So what does a daily routine look like for you that helps keep you feeling however you feel on a day-to-day basis? I was going to say healthy and happy, but I'll let you in words to how you feel on a day-to-day basis.
To be honest, probably my work, okay, because I enjoy my work. I'm not someone who's like, "Oh, it's Monday, I need to go to work. I hate my job." Like, I love my job. I love going and speaking to all different types of women. So usually I'll get up at 5 a.m. and I'll be at work for 6. And I'll work from 6 till maybe 12 or 1 or 2, depending on the day. And then I'll train myself. And then I'll come home, I'll do some laptop work, I'll go a walk. I invest a lot of time in making sure that my nutrition is on point, making sure that I've got plenty of healthy fats and things, because I know how important that is for women, for hormones. So that's something that I really do try and focus on. I read as well, or try and listen to podcasts and things like that, trying for my own personal development. So yeah, I kind of fill my time with that sort of stuff after work.
So, is there anything else that you want to talk about today?
don't think so. I've probably saddened everyone enough for today.
I would say inspired, because
inspired.
Been through everything that you went through, and there was a point where you had choices. Like, if you had stayed with your mum, you could have ended up on that same path as her, and that's in that same situation. So you have made inspiring choices and been able to recognize where there are people there that can help you, and embraced that, and then been able to grow from that. So in my eyes, you're absolutely inspirational.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's nice to hear.
In such, like, I feel very honoured that you've shared as much of that story as you
that's,
know.
That's, I think that's, that. This is probably the first time that I have. My sister and me, like, my sister and my brother have got their own experiences as well. That's not my place to share that. Theirs are very different to mine, in their own ways. My sister and me, we've spoke about maybe putting, like, our experiences together and maybe doing a book and stuff like that. But we'll see. We'll see.
Because it has to feel right when you do a book.
Yes, yes.
It has to be for the right outcome, like, for the right reason, and to be sharing something this much.
I would say so, because me and my sister both went through a period of time where, do you know the white books that you can buy that are about care and abuse and all that sort of thing? You never seen them before. So there's a book called is it A Child Called It? And then it goes on to A Man Called Dave. I read those books, and the abuse that that wee boy suffered was absolutely horrific. Like, there was nothing even on the scale of what I went through. And the story that came out of that, and how he changed his life, and what an inspiration that man was. Like, have you heard of it before?
Yeah, I've read that. Yeah. I read
it
a
lot. Like, that story was unbelievable. So it was. And that's why we kind of spoke about, it's like, just if there was anyone else out there that had went through the similar thing, or if there was a woman who was stuck, I don't know, in a relationship or whatever, you know, just to say to them that there are choices out there, you know, you there is help available. So, yeah.
Well, I would definitely be reading that and recommending that book on to other people when it gets written.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Definitely, definitely. So if people are listening to this and they want to follow you on social media or reach out to you about coaching that you offer, where are the best places for them to find you?
So they can find me on Instagram. I'm Megan McLean PT, although I'm Megan Stewart. And same thing on Facebook, Megan McLean PT.
Perfect. What I'll do is I'll put those links into the show notes so that people can read them quite easily. Thank you so much for sharing your story and being the inspiration, the positive outcome inspiration from a wild journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me stop recording.